Welcome to the Family Express podcast, where our destination is resilient and connected families. Come aboard with your hosts, marriage and family therapists, Catherine DeBruin and Rhonda Evans, to explore the world of emotionally focused family therapy, a model developed by Sue Johnson and colleagues. Together with our guest speakers, our travels will map the EFFT landscape, highlighting lessons learned, shared fears, and the passion and curiosity that bonds our community.
Welcome back, listeners, to the next episode of the Family Express podcast with Catherine DeBruin and Rhonda Evans. Our guest speaker today is Wendy Gage, here to talk to us about a topic close to her heart. Wendy, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I feel super honored that you reached out and asked to speak with me.
Yeah, we're excited to have you here. And just from reviewing your notes, I can tell that you have a lot of really valuable information, and I can also feel your heart coming through, your compassion and your validation. So I'm really leaning into the conversation. And maybe a place to start for today is to hear about what got you started with this particular work. So tell us what your work is and what your focus is, what your niche is, and how did you find it?
Sure. I think it found me more than I found it. So I always, I'm a registered social worker up in Ontario, Canada. I always knew I wanted to work with children and family. And when I was doing my training, I was definitely working in that area. I lucked out soon after graduating and got hired on as a contract social worker at the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto. So I was on quite a lot of programs at the very beginning, but really settled into the neurology program and just had like a really supportive medical team who really valued the role that I could bring as a social worker, not just in kind of doing traditional hospital social work, which is like plugging holes and holding up walls and actually doing therapy with families and with children often diagnosed with a chronic condition, disability, sometimes cognitively or physically. And so that kind of brought me into family work, and I've continued in family work kind of my whole career.
Wow. So once you're in it, you never left it.
It keeps following me.
Well, you must have a heart for it to stay in it. You must have a part of you that like kind of could not do the work. It just sounds like it's a part of who you are.
I think so. I mean, like I think I said, it kind of has followed me a little bit, but I think also that I found myself having a real soft spot for all of these families, both from the pain and suffering that they experienced, but also just at times feeling like they were my greater teachers than I was theirs.
Mm. Wendy, it's so nice to have you here. And I love that reflection that the work has just followed you. And it sounds like you have learned so much and that you love learning. And I was wondering, what do you like the most about working with these families?
I think I could get bored easily of the same old thing. I think it's, and there's a part of my brain that is kept busy learning and kept busy being curious. And so I feel like there's always been more to grow and more to learn and more to understand. And because of the complexities in a family system around a child who is ill or disabled, I think those complexities keep me wondering and learning more and more and interested.
Thank you. Thank you for being willing to teach us as well. And I'm wondering, like, what themes have you seen when working with these families, or what challenges do you tend to come across?
Well, I think that's the first thing, is that everybody hears the story of my child is not well and thinks challenge. But what I would say, like from an attachment perspective is, and this would have been some of my own new learning too. When I was working at SickKids, I wasn't doing EFT. It wasn't until after. And some of the things that maybe I saw, or patterns I saw when I was working there, I started understanding from a different kind of lens when I understood about attachment. So a lot of what might look like really activation in the caregiving system, what we might refer to as like a helicopter parent or maybe a parent that's doing too much, might actually just be exactly the right amount in a family system where a child is chronically ill or disabled. Sometimes we'll see that the caregiving is not aligned with the child's developmental stage, and that can cause some tricky situations. But for me, like when I think about that, like if we really understand that attachment is like our main survival strategy, we understand like a baby without a caring parent responding to that baby's need is not going to survive.
Yes.
If we kind of understand that like health is on the line here, so of yep. course it's activated, right?
Yeah. So you're saying, Wendy, that like that family system is in crisis to some degree because there is a problem, there's an illness, and parents are having to overfunction or they're anxious for good reason, trying to be responsive in that system?
I think definitely like around things like health crises or times where things are worse or times where things are more difficult, I think you definitely see a lot more activation in the parenting system. But I also think even over time, even during stability, like living life with that kind of difference requires a different kind of responsiveness from the parenting system. So what might look normal or not normal in a family where the kids are healthy.
Yeah.
When a kid is not healthy, we might think that's overactivation, but it might not be overactivation.
You're making me think of actually my husband's family. He grew up with very, very bad asthma and almost died and was in and out of the hospital as a baby and, you know, as a young child. And every time that he gets sick now, like the whole family system goes into kind of like a fear mode, right? Like they're ready to expect the worst because any cold can become a hospital visit. And it's an entirely different feeling in the family system than a regular child just getting sick, getting a cold.
That's had a role, right? Like that activation of the system likely has been learned over time and is probably also averted some crises, right? And been helpful.
Mm-hmm. Could you give, I really appreciate what you're saying about the overactivation or the more activation. And the one that struck me a bit was parental involvement that might not align with the developmental stage. Like intuitively, I think I know what you're talking about, but would you be able to give our listeners an example?
Yeah, like you, you know, like a parent might give their kid a lot more sort of a lot more space or a lot more autonomy around adolescence. They might become less involved in the child's day-to-day activities or decisions, and you might see more activation or more involvement with the kid that doesn't quite align with the developmental stage because of their health needs. And there may be real times where the kid actually needs to lean on the parent in a way that they wouldn't normally lean on their parent at that age and stage.
Got it. I had a feeling that you were talking about, so it was just good to kind of close the circle. What is it called? Close the gap, circle the loop on that one?
Yeah, and I think too, when I think about it, like that also can create a lot of crises in the family system. Like adolescence is often a time when we have like chronic illness or chronic injury, disability, all of that. Adolescence is often a bit of a crisis time where the kid might rebel against parents and rebel against that. They might not want to take their treatment, or they might want to acknowledge their diagnosis, or they may want to go in a very different direction than their parents would want for them to come. And they can get into kind of these crises around those times that is scary for parents and scary for the kid too, because it could involve their health.
Oh, say more about that, Wendy. That I'm curious about that. Is that in reaction to the diagnosis? Is that just regular adolescent kind of pushing away and launching, but then that's a normal developmental phase, but it has medical implications.
Exactly.
Oh, scary. How scary. And then the negative cycles I can imagine the parent and child get into around that. Oh, tell us more about this.
Yeah. Well, and I think about this time when I was at Sick Kids Hospital. I was on the gastroenterology program, and there was like this natural support group of boys on the ward, teenage boys on the ward. And the referral I got was from the nurses because they were having wheelchair races down the hallways when everybody had left. And I was like, hey, wheelchair races sounds like a good way to rebel. Like, are they taking their meds? Are they following their treatment? They were like, yeah. And I'm like, let them ride. Like I would so much rather have them doing that than have them not taking their treatment. And actually, it was kind of this really cool reframe for everybody, family included. Like, oh, well, I mean, doing something kind of normal here. And instead of it being in their medication or in their treatment.
And they took that reframe. Hey, they understood that.
They did. I was like, oh, okay. This is much better for them.
I was curious about the opposite scenario. I don't know if that's the way to say it. A scenario where a teenager from an outsider perspective seems to like over-identify with their diagnosis or with their condition, or an outsider again might assess the parental involvement as over or too much in the adolescent years, maybe at a time when developmentally that outsider might expect the parents to be backing off a bit more.
Yeah, I think you're also talking about the system that's around these families, right? Because there's like a row of experts at the front seat of their life that's like watching everything that they're doing. And some of those people are being really friendly and wonderful and supportive. And some are being judgmental and not really understanding the context in which the family is acting in the way they're acting. So I think that's kind of like that outsider looking at it going, you know, thinking, how could they do that without understanding the context? And if you understand that context, it actually makes a lot more sense that you might see overprotection. You might see parents struggling in how do you navigate these tricky kind of conversations with your kid when their development is also changing? Or how do you get more flexible with your kid when you're afraid that flexibility means something's going to happen with their health?
Yo, I love that, Wendy. That's important perspective always to consider the context. And it sounds like to do a good developmental history of the family, because you might be seeing this family a little later when the health crisis isn't as imminent, asking about illnesses, hospitalizations, medication, right? Will help us understand that early environmental background.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, if that's happening at the beginning of parenting as well, how that affects like parental confidence, right? Like seeing a new parent whose kid is diagnosed with something hard is like, it's already hard enough being a new parent, but to be a new parent and something's wrong with the kid or something's going on with the kid's health, it really, that sort of security really gets shifted because of that. And sometimes it makes sense, like the need is still there. The need to be more involved is still there. And for a lot of kids, they'd actually rather have their parents being the ones that are involved in that than, say, an outside caregiver or like a personal support worker or another person or a friend. The person they actually want involved in those things is their parent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you just got me thinking about one of our recent podcast episodes with Dr. Tat Ying Wong, you know, talking about an adolescent who wants their parent involved in their like individual treatment or individual therapy sessions. And when there is a chronic illness or chronic condition, it makes a lot of sense that even an adolescent would want their parent there. It makes a lot of sense to me, right? Because that parent represents, in my eyes, I think that it would make sense to me that parent represents security at a place where there's a lot of uncertainty and unpredictability for that teenager, like that adolescent.
Yeah, exactly.
What about the sibling subsystem, Wendy? How do you see like sibling development and relationships affected in these kinds of families who are managing the kind of health?
Yeah, another big thing you kind of see, right? It's like you see the whole family system organizes around the child that's often organizing around the child that's ill. So what's quite common is to see siblings become more protective. So what they might do is shut down their own needs, like be a really good kid in order to not exhaust the whole family system. The other thing we can see is things like jealousy. I used to walk into rooms if I was working with sibs, and I'd say, "So, what does your brother or sister get that you don't get and you wish you had?" And they'd be like, "Mom never gives them chicken nuggets, but they ordered chicken nuggets here for them." Or they get to miss school. Or if they did miss school and they didn't have a test and didn't do well, they get to do all these things. And so some of the things that are just accommodations for the situation feel like rewards, or could feel like mattering more to the sibling. So opening up a conversation around that, because it often feeling kind of ashamed of having those feelings, even though they're really normal.
I just want to quickly emphasize that question. I love that question, Wendy. Like, what are you not getting that your sibling's getting? Like, you know, just inviting sort of the envy or the jealousy. I often will walk into a family session, especially with teens, and say, "Hey, where would you rather be right now? But I really like this one for your family. So yeah, what do you feel like they're getting more of than you right now?" And it just catches them off guard, and they're likely to be honest, and then whoop, it's out in the open. Right?
Yeah. It's having a place and a person to talk about that with, you know, and giving them that quote unquote safe space, you know, that you invite them to let that part of themselves come forward. I think that's really special. I think that's really awesome.
And normalizing it too. It just really like, yeah, everyone feels this way instead of them kind of holding on to it. Yeah. Yeah. So we can see that. We can also see when things stabilize, like just when it's getting stable and when the parents are really hoping for a breath, it's like the siblings are like, "I'm not okay." Instead of acting out in reaction, that can be quite confusing for parents, because all along they've had this really good, really strong kid. Yeah.
Interesting. So as soon as it becomes safer and more stable, then it's safer for everyone to let their feelings out and start experiencing them. And if that's framed or understood, it can look like a backlash, maybe.
Or be confusing. Like, who is this kid?
Yeah.
Or why is this happening now?
So you're saying in these families where there's some sort of a medical crisis, you're likely to see some strong caregiving of one another, whether it's from siblings or from parents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's beautiful you say that, right? Because the literature on the siblings, it has like some really beautiful lessons learned too, right? Like kids who grow up with a sibling who has some kind of disability are actually like, they grow in their empathy at an earlier age. They grow in their compassion at an earlier age, which is like a really beautiful quality. And it's kind of the hope and the meaning is like, yes, we're going through this thing as a family that's hard, but there's also some things that we learn because of this hard experience that's actually quite beautiful.
There's some really good byproducts, right, in becoming empathic and developing caregiving and sensitivity, as long as it's not at our own extreme, at our own detriment, right? I mean, those are very important qualities to learn.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And the question is whether that's imbalance or not, right? I suppose.
That's what you're looking for, right? Are these things... are they rigid ways? Are they working for the family? Are they creating, are they creating imbalances in the family? Are they blocking, are they blocking caregiving? Are they blocking the child's ability to reach to the parent?
Yeah, that's good. So even if it is there, it's going to be apparent, but is it talked about? Is it validated? Is it acknowledged? Is it, you know, rewarded, I suppose, or at least understood.
Understood. Yeah.
Yeah. So what kind of blocks do you find when you're working with a family system like this? What kind of a parental block is pretty typical for you to run into?
The blocks around those shifts can be a big one. So like when the kid's moving to a different developmental stage and needs maybe a different kind of role with the parent or a different kind of relationship with the parent, there can be more rigidity around shifting. So, you know, I think about this family that I'm working with where the teen kid is not going to school and they're just doubling down on everything they've done before and really losing their balance, losing their ability to have flexibility, you know, and really actually framing it within this kid's disability instead of being able to see that it's all in this developmental thing of this kid saying, I don't have a voice. And this is my protest. And this is my, I am taking a stand. I have like chained myself to the tree and I'm not moving until they hear me. I don't have control. And so, and that can be really hard. It can be really scary to listen, to hear your kid when, you know, it's that kind of crisis. I think there's a lot of blocks around the grief. You know, the grief is a different kind of grief, right? It's not like someone's died. It's what's called ambiguous loss, right? So it's like a teeter-totter. It's like, you know, some days you're feeling really hopeful. We can do this. Everything's good. Our life is going to be fine. We're well-equipped with all the things we need to do to deal with whatever this thing is. And we've got it and everything's good and we don't have to worry. And then it can also be, our life is so different. There is so much loss. It's never going to be the same. It's never going to be anything. And kind of getting into these two positions.
Yeah,
there can be a box around like making space for that ambiguous loss, both from, you know, blocks around talking about it. You know, we sort of often say to parents, like, don't cry in front of your kids. But when it comes to grief and loss, it can actually be somewhat helpful to lead the kid through the grief by saying, I'm also sad, and expressing some of that sadness.
Yeah.
So I think that's another place where people can get really blocked. I think, so that's a big piece. I think the other part is like the parents get blocked around their value, like around seeing themselves as able and capable to face what they're facing.
Oh, the parents?
I think so. I mean, I hear a lot of that, right? When I'm working with parents, like,
can I do this? Can I get through this?
Yeah, yeah. And like intrinsically, like we want to catch the bullet, right? For our kids. And when the bullet has hit your kid because the bullet was bigger than you or faster than you or trickier than you, whatever, and you are able to catch the bullet, right? It can really, really erode at confidence.
Because your role as a parent sometimes is to protect your child, but then there's some things you can't protect them from. And so there's this helplessness around seeing your child suffer. You would probably take it on your own shoulders if you could, but you can't. But watching a loved one suffering is just mortifying. And so I'm hearing you're saying with these parents, there's so much more emotion. There's more fear, there's more grief, and then there's this helplessness and this questioning of self. Like you're saying, Wendy, that in the developmental stages, as children grow out of one stage and enter into another, it's normal to have growing pains. And we have some just expected fears, right, as we're changing. But then these parents' fears are way bigger. And then when they consider what their child is having to live without in every stage and looking forward into the future, they have to grieve everything that their child's not going to be able to do as easily or have as easily. So the grief is way bigger. And then that can erode their sense of value as a parent or their own confidence. I mean, they're also caregivers, right? So if they're not, we know that caregiving can burn us out if we're not getting enough self-care. And so they can easily question their own value or feel incredibly helpless. Oh, that's a lot of emotion that they're having to work through.
And you know, Catherine, you said something about that, about caregiver burnout. And there was this study done in the NICU on caregiver burnout, right? The NICUs. And actually what they found was more predictive of caregiver burnout was not the amount of work that the parent had to do. It was how effective they felt in the work that they were doing or in the caregiving role. So it's actually really, so it's intertwined with that sort of good view of yourself as a strong and confident parent, right? So if you're not thinking about yourself as a parent, then how can you feel effective? Because you're probably saying to yourself, I'm not very good at this. I'm failing at this. I'm not doing a good enough job. And then that makes the burden of caregiving even heavier.
That's such an important piece, Wendy. I think that's such an important piece that if you hadn't told me about that, I'm not so sure I would have been able to hear that or pick that up with the parents I was working with. I know I can like hear it in other contexts, but in this particular one, I'm not so sure I would have been able to hear it. And I just really appreciate you making that really explicit. Also, I love anything that's backed by research. I'm a research enthusiast, just like our beloved late Dr. Sue Johnson. So I just really appreciate knowing that that's as a clinician, because I have some experience, but I have very little, I would say much less than you, right? Working with families who are navigating life like this. I just love that that's something that I can be more intentional about bringing into conversation. So thank you so much.
Well, I know me as a therapist know how to work with that, right? We know how to work with parental intent. We know how to take this sort of block of seeing oneself as a failure, and we know how to shift that into parental intent and help them find their value and how important they are, and that they're way more than important. None of the people that are involved in their child's life come to their homes at night and hold their child tight when it's hard. Only they not, right? So we have like a beautiful model that we can use to target that.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's so well said. I'm sort of stuck back in a memory right now. What my third child, I was in the NICU with her for 2 weeks after she was born. She had a breathing and heart issue. And I was sleeping on like a chair for 2 weeks, staying there with her. I was recovering from surgery. And what started happening is that every nurse who came in to take care of her wanted me to help them. And so and there was a different nurse every day for like 12 hours, you know. And so I was getting completely burnt out because I was basically working each shift with whichever nurse came by. And I remember just getting completely exhausted and not sleeping. And then one of the nurses, and I'm remembering this now, one of the nurses noticed that. I think one day I just burst into tears or something. And she said, you know what, mommy? Even though you're able to do this, you need to take care of yourself. And on my shift, you're not going to do anything. I'm going to take care of you. Let's just put that to me right now.
Oh, look, Catherine, that's so precious. Thank you for sharing that with us. I'm just looking at Wendy and both of us just kind of like our shoulders drop and our kind of air comes out of our lungs.
I think each nurse wanted to activate me because I was there. Like I was obviously there because I wanted to be involved with the baby. Obviously it's important to be involved with your baby, but each nurse didn't realize that each of them was trying to do that with me. And then I completely was not sleeping and almost lost it.
Well, it kind of makes me also think about how in EFFT we hold the parent so the parent can hold the kid, right? Mm-hmm. And it's kind of what that nurse did, right? Because I imagine as you were interacting with your child, with all of that exhaustion inside of you and just like nothing in the tank and no one really seeing that. It's not like you're learning at that point. It's not like you're anything, right? And here she saw you and she held you.
So that you could hold your baby.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, that is quite a moment being seen in that way as a parent.
I love that. It makes me think too of one of the other things I was thinking about with this topic, which is like validating parental instincts. And I have my own story with a mom who was told that she should not try nursing her baby, like give up on it, give up on it, give up on it. She was like, I am not giving up on that.
Yeah.
She like, I am nursing my baby and you can't tell me otherwise. I'm going to get this baby to latch. I'm giving this baby breast milk. And it was like the one thing she could do.
Yeah.
Right. So nothing else she could do. She's completely helpless. And later on, there was a dietitian that bumped into her like years later and said, you were my inspiration for listening to parents and their instincts and succumbing instincts, because there was inside of you that was saying, do this. And you fought hard for that. She said, but now when I hear that voice and I see that persistence in a parent, like I just like, you go mom, you go parent.
Really? Like watching for that and then nurturing and growing that. That's wonderful. Because especially like that instinct is starting to grow, like it's coming alive. I really like that, Wendy. And I'm going back to like my own memory again. Like if the nurse had said, wow, mom, you're tired, you need to sleep. Or wow, mom, you need to take a break, you're recovering from surgery. Like that would have felt so bad, like I was being pushed aside. But she didn't. She said, mom, I think you've been working so hard on every shift with each of us that I think you need someone to take care of you. You know what I mean? Like she did see the intention. She validated my caregiving, right? And she said, you've been doing such a good job.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah. And that makes a big difference, right? Seeing the good in us, right?
Yes. Which honestly, like just makes me think about when therapists say, I don't want to work with families or I don't want to work with kids because I don't want to work with the parents. And the sadness I feel about that is because, well, the irony is if you're working with adults, individual adults who are parents, you're working with parents. That's the irony to me. But I just think the sadness is that parents need to be seen and validated and resourced and shored up just as much as kids do. And when I hear these stories of what of Catherine and Wendy, what you two just shared, it's resourcing the parent is a huge part of helping a family become resilient. It's like all of the first work of what we do in stage one of EFFT. And by doing that, we make such an impact. We have the potential to make such an impact on the system. And I just get so much from working with parents, you know? I don't know, it's on my own tangent, perhaps.
I think it's important though, right? It's like also for the kid, right? Because when we do that, then the kid can see these things that may have felt very negative from the parent in a very different kind of way, right? They can take in, like when mom is freaking out, it's because mom cares about my future, right? Or when she's taking control, it's because she's scared of losing me and I have value and I matter.
Right.
Wendy, you once told me a story that really stayed with me and I was wondering if you would retell it for our listeners.
Uh-huh.
About you being a wheelchair.
About me being a wheelchair, yes. Me and my own daughter, and this would be my just enough caregiving, which looked to the other as too much. So I have two kids with ADHD. And my daughter, who is now a young adult, is in college and she has accommodations and she works really hard and I'm super proud of her. But the whole organizing and planning and figuring out what she's got to do and what order of assignments has got to get done. And even just sometimes going over the instructions and following them, that whole thing takes her so much. And she had a prof that was really, really poorly organized and was not meeting her accommodation plan. And it was bad enough that I complained, and I got the director of the program contacting me. And while I was talking to her about my daughter and what my daughter's needs were and what my daughter's accommodations were and what we'd like to see going forward, she said, "Can I give you some advice?" And I've heard this phrase many, many times. And I said, "Sure, okay." And she said, she basically told me to back off. She said, "You know, maybe let your daughter be the advocate. You know, maybe you need to give her a little space, a little independence, let her take care of these things on her own." And I remember taking in a breath, and I said to her, "Listen," I said, "I hear that a lot and I appreciate what you're saying, but I just want to let you know right now, I'm not being my daughter's helicopter mom. I'm being my daughter's wheelchair right now." And she just went, "Ugh." And so it's just an example, right, Catherine, of how what is functional, right? And that was an agreement my daughter and I had. It's because we have our relationship that I can say to her, "How do you feel about me taking that role on? And if you don't want me to be the one that takes that role on, to let you focus on your studies, by all means, we'll find someone else to play that role." And she was like, "No, I don't want to have to ask anyone but you," right? "I trust you. I trust how you'll advocate for me. I trust how you'll set that up for me." It's because of our relationship that she wanted me to be that role for her, right?
You made it an out loud conversation. You negotiated it with your daughter so that she understood you were trying to be helpful, but you were willing to shift if she wanted to take it back over. I love how you just navigated.
So it's so collaborative,
right?
You know, it's different. A helicopter parent just goes in and does. And it's not a conversation. It's not explicit. They just think they see the need and they go in. I love this analogy or metaphor, I'm not sure which, of the wheelchair. It's a partnership, right? The person and the wheelchair is a partnership. It's a collaborative. They have to work in sync with each other. I just think it is so different from that helicopter.
And when you got the negative feedback from that lady, you held on to your sense of self, your parental instinct, your protective response. And you were like, "No, this is what I'm doing." When you could have like taken that in and just received it very negatively, right? You knew what you were doing and why. You were built up and you were confident as a mama bear and you stood your ground. And it was effective. And you did it in a non-reactionary way with this.
Right? Such a balanced response.
Wow.
Wendy. Gives me chills.
That's a good story, right? Thank you for sharing that, Wendy. I appreciate it. I don't think I'll ever forget that.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, that's why I think we want to help these our parents find in these families and find their confidence when they're navigating really choppy waters, right? It's hard to steer the ship when the waters are that rocky all the time.
So, yeah, unpredictable, uncertain, don't know what's going to happen next. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wendy, thank you so much for being here. If I had my wits about me, I might offer a summary right about now.
Well, I'm hearing us say that there are families that are dealing with some very, very, very taxing circumstances, medical issues, disabilities, where it is so painful. And it's painful on an ongoing basis because there's fear involved. There's tremendous amount of loss. If you're constantly caught up in crisis, it's also hard to have time to process all of those feelings. And it can be very easy for these families to misunderstand developmental milestones and give their children the space that they might need to launch and to grow. And if that's misunderstood or misattuned to, that can easily develop into a negative pattern between the parent and child. And so you're helping us remember to look out for this. You're helping us remember that when that parent becomes a parent, see their instincts, build them up, trust what, find their parental intent. These are the families that need extra TLC and love and care and advocacy. And thank you so much for walking us through what some of those parental blocks might look like so that we can come alongside some of these families and maybe even be a wheelchair to some of them. Thank you, Wendy.
Thank you. I love that.
I'm totally inspired by you, Wendy, and the just the breadth and wealth of knowledge that you bring and your experience. And I'm so inspired. I have a book bubbling in my head, so we'll see what I can do with it over Christmas.
Go for it, Rhonda. Go for it.
Wendy, thank you so much for being here. Thank you for your time. This is actually, listeners, this is our final episode release of 2024. I meant to do a count of how many episodes we've done so far, but I don't have that. 27. So this will be released on December 31st, the 27th episode of 2024. So thank you, Wendy, so much for being our final episode of our first year. We appreciate you being here. Thank you so much.
Happy holidays, everybody. Take good care. Look forward to seeing you next year.
That's it for today, folks. Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you again for our next journey.